Okay, we're here. Hi, Connor.
In the living room this
time. We are actually in the living room. This is fun. Actually, once I got a couple of pillows behind my back, I now feel much, much better. But we're glad to have you guys with us. We're glad that you guys are here for our book review. Now, you might have noticed we've done a book review before called Animal Farm. You guys definitely should read the book and then listen to that podcast. I don't mean to boast, but I actually, it's one of my favorite podcasts that we have done.
It's definitely been one of my
favorite
as well. The conversation was intriguing and deep and broad. It was relevant, you know, not only to the book, but also to today. That one was a lot of fun. A lot of symbolism to kind of guess at and just see what our perspectives were.
Right.
And we would love y'all's perspective. So if you've read it, and especially if you've read it and listened to the podcast, we would love your comments anywhere on social media, YouTube, you name it. Any feedback to engage with us?
Yeah, no, for sure. I second that. But this is going to be a little bit different. That one was a super long one. I mean, super long.
It was a super long podcast. Yeah. Short book, a lot of meanings. This is kind of the opposite. We're actually breaking this up into several sections. We'll probably be doing at least 10 of these.
Eight or nine of these.
Covering 10 letters at a time from the Federalist Papers.
Yep, that's right. So as we've been talking about for a couple months, we're going to go through the Federalist Papers. These podcasts are going to be a little bit shorter just because the Federalist Papers is a little bit meatier. It is a lot more. So we've just figured it'd be better to kind of break it up, talk about it a little bit, and then kind of leave it to you. If you want to read some of these, I think you should.
Yep.
But if you don't want to,
you can pick up copies off Amazon anywhere from like $5 to $12. You can also literally find them online. Just type in "Read the Federalist Papers" and you'll find several websites with them.
Right. That's correct. You absolutely can. So today we're going to kind of talk about some of the first letters, but also kind of do a little bit of an overview and discuss kind of the origins of the Federalist Papers, who wrote these, and why we think that they're important. I think the reason why I was attracted to these is because I watched myself and those my age in pure ignorance in bashing America as if it was just the worst thing that was ever created. I was like, you know, I wonder how many of them actually have read the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. or the Federalist Papers. And then I thought to myself, I haven't read the Federalist Papers. I would like to know more about what I'm choosing to defend, things I agree with, things I disagree with. And I want people to be able to do the same, even if you disagree. Like, I think it's cool, like, if you're going to go against it, you might as well know what you're going against. So I have mm-hmm. read the Constitution a couple of times already. I think it's fairly easy to read for the most part. The language is a little bit older, but you can kind of get a feel for it. And most, again, you can find that
reading through
online.
It kind of reminded me of the reading through the Ten Commandments. It's like, oh, 10. Very simple. But then you get into the breakdown of it, which is kind of the Federalist Papers for the Constitution. And it's like, for the breakdown of the Ten Commandments, you get into the, 600 and... I'm going to forget. There's 600 and something laws that basically expound off of the Ten Commandments. I feel like the Constitution was about the equivalent, where it's like, this kind of lays out the bare bones of everything, and then the Federalist Papers go into explaining how all of that should work, and that's where things get more complicated.
Right. And so we have the Constitution. We all know the Constitution. We all know that we have it.
We all know about it.
We all know about it.
We don't know it.
Yes. I know, everyone knows at least the Second Amendment because they're all so dang against it. So that's why they know
about it.
And the
First Amendment. First and Second. That's usually about where people stop.
Yep. First and Second. Then plead the Fifth. But anywho.
We don't talk about the Third and the Fourth.
I wish that more people, when they were losing an argument, would just be like, you know what? I plead the Fifth. I'm done. I think I'm defeated. I can't do this anymore. I think I'm going to do that next time I start losing an argument. But before the Constitution, there was the Articles of the Confederacy. That was what they had first put together. And then,
yes, that was originally what kind of had them banded together and what they initially started making some of the treaties with other countries and stuff. That's what they had all through the war for independence was the Confederate papers or
articles.
Confederate articles. I'm going to continue to get these mixed up.
You keep doing that. It's so interesting.
Yep. Don't know where that happened.
It's okay. I think something just got messed up in your brain. You're just like, oh. anyway, so there are the articles of the Confederacy. Now, there are some issues with it. So they came together. And from what we know, there were a lot of issues with it.
Yes.
There were just like holes and things that, you know, I think as I was reading the Federalist Papers, I think there's a lot of holes in it in regards to checks and balances of like who has more power over what. That
not,
was kinda,
not the Federalist Papers having the huge holes in it for checks and balances.
The articles of the Confederacy. Yes. Mm-hmm.
The sounds that I got from the beginning of this. What was it that Hamilton quoted? He said,
there's a lot of things that he said.
I must not have saved it. It was in his opening statement. I'm gonna find it real quick. Hang on just a second here.
Okay, but basically while you're looking that up, essentially they kind of scrapped the Articles of the Confederacy, and then we have now the Constitution. But not everyone was necessarily sold on the Constitution. And so what we see from these papers at least is that we have three authors. Why am I struggling to say this?
Were you about to say Pluto?
No. Publius, right?
I actually haven't run into that name from when I was reading. I've heard.
No, that's how they. That's how they sign
from
the name.
Some overviews.
Yeah, that's how they sign. I just can't. It's such a weird word for me.
Is it in your book?
Yeah.
Can I see it?
Yeah, it is. Hang
it's
on.
Not in the. It's not in the online version.
Publius. Oh my gosh. This is such a weird word. Like, I've read it so many times. I was like, Publius. Publius. But that's what they signed these articles, and these went into the newspapers. So they weren't necessarily put into a book form until later. But that's how they signed it. And by they, it is multiple people, not the pronoun where you're non-binary and you go by they. We have Alexander Hamilton. Most people will know now from the play. James Madison and John Jay. Connor, did you find that quote?
Yes, I did. It's actually his very opening statement, which was after an unequivocal experience of the inefficiency of the subsisting federal government, you are called upon to deliberate on a new constitution for the United States of America. It was a very strong first part of the sentence. It was like, yeah, this is an utter failure.
Yeah.
Basically. And subsisting essentially meaning to support itself. So the government that's supposed to support itself is inefficient, and it's unequivocal, and everybody's experienced it. It's how this starts out.
Right.
Little bit of background on each of them, and we'll start off with John Jay, who has the least contributions to all of these letters, but that is due to him being sick.
Apparently, from what I was reading, apparently he was asked to join, and he did join in, and he actually wrote, I believe, the first four or five of the articles, and he got sick, and then Hamilton and Madison took over. I believe that Jay was on one subject. They have letters that are a continuation of the same subject. So a lot of the first letters are about the idea of being the advantages of being a union and protecting the union from how a union would protect from domestic and foreign powers. Mm-hmm. So I think when I'm just inferring here, but I feel like when Jay got sick, Madison took over, or Hamilton, I don't remember which one, but they took over the subject that he was going into.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, just to give a little background here to Mr. John Jay. According to history.com, John Jay was an American statesman and founding father who served the United States in numerous government offices. The New York native drafted the state's first constitution in 1777 and was chosen president of the Continental Congress the following year. Jay served as the key negotiator at the Treaty of Paris, which ended the American Revolutionary War and recognized the independence of the United States. He later served as the first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court and the second governor of New York State. Our second writer is going to be James Madison. James Madison was a founding father of the United States and the fourth American president, serving in office from 1809 to 1817. An advocate for a strong federal government, the Virginia-born Madison composed the first drafts of the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights and earned the nickname Father of the Constitution. In 1792, Madison and Thomas Jefferson founded the Democratic-Republican Party, which has been called America's first opposition political party. When Jefferson became the third U.S. president, Madison served as his Secretary of State. In this role, he oversaw the Louisiana Purchase from the French in 1803, and during his presidency, Madison led the U.S. into the controversial War of 1812 against Great Britain. After 2 terms in the White House, Madison retired to his Virginia plantation, Montpelier, with his wife. And then the last one I saved for the end is Alexander Hamilton, because it gets a little bit intriguing with him, because we'll get to it in a sec.
Okay.
But born into obscurity in the British West Indies, Alexander Hamilton made his reputation during the Revolutionary War and became one of America's most influential founding fathers. He was an impassioned champion of a strong federal government and played a key role in defending and ratifying the U.S. Constitution. As the first Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, Hamilton built a financial foundation for the new nation against fierce opposition from arch-rival Thomas Jefferson. The differences between the two men would help shape the nation's first political parties. Hamilton's outspoken, polarizing style of politics and an embarrassing sex scandal limited his later career prospects, and in 1804, he was killed in a duel by Aaron Burr, another longtime political foe.
I have heard of Aaron Burr. I have heard of him.
So Aaron Burr, this is not the first time he's occurred in his life.
I feel like there's a reason why they started dueling. So I was like, they must have like some kind of beef.
No.
Really?
They're super strong political opponents. Hamilton was so against Burr as a person that he was just not a good person in private. He didn't practice what he preached, basically. That he guided his career at stopping Burr from getting into office, whatever it took. In fact, helping Thomas Jefferson get elected over Burr.
Oh my gosh. So his hate. So the enemy, was it the enemy of my enemy? Yeah. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. That is, wow.
It was, it's really interesting to read through. I'm trying to see, okay, so his rivalry with Aaron Burr. We'll read a little bit about this, and then I want to hit on the sex scandal, because he is the first official political sex scandal for the country.
Okay.
Which is, like, literally at the start. But his rivalry with Aaron Burr. So beyond his bitter feud with Jefferson, Hamilton's combative personality and policymaking style brought him into frequent conflicts. According to historian Joanne Freeman, he was involved in no fewer than 10 affairs of honor, or near duels, before the notorious 1804 duel that took his life. Hamilton and Aaron Burr had been political opponents since the debate over the Constitution in 1789. Burr angered Hamilton further by running successfully against Hamilton's father-in-law, Philip Schuyler, S-C-H-U-Y-L-E-R. That's the best I'm going to do at pronouncing that. For the U.S. Senate in 1791. I'm going to be a little bit dyslexic for this. I fear Burr is unprincipled both as a public and private man, Hamilton wrote in 1792, adding that I feel it a religious duty to oppose his career.
Okay, but then he has a sex scandal.
Yeah, so in the sex scandal, okay, it doesn't really make sense when he's like, that he says he's unprincipled in public and private. But he makes good on this in 1800 after Federalist divisions led to a tie between Jefferson and Burr, both Democrat Republicans. Remember, this is one party at the time. in the 1800 presidential election. Even though Jefferson had long been his political rival, Hamilton helped sway Federalists in Congress to vote in Jefferson's favor to break the tie and defeat Burr. So he's had like a lifetime rivalry with Jefferson. He's like, I can't stand you, but I hate this guy more, so...
I will. Doesn't sound too different from what happens now.
Today, no, it sounds identical.
Sounds this like is... Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. The question is, which one does Harris hate more, Biden or Trump? Go ahead.
Yeah, so his career kind of gets sidelined due to some of this stuff. Well, a lot of it results from the sex scandal. So what happened is he torpedoed his own presidential ambitions in 1797 when he published a tell-all pamphlet about the sordid details of his affair with a married woman. As the first secretary of the U.S. Treasury, Alexander Hamilton built the foundations of the national banking system, wielded more power in the early years of American democracy than any other man besides George Washington. Yet unlike Washington and unlike his longtime nemesis, Thomas Jefferson, Hamilton never served as U.S. president, not only because he died in a duel by the hands of Aaron Burr. Now, what goes on is that this lady, I think it's Maria Reynolds, essentially, well, let me get through this paragraph, these next two paragraphs, and then I'll try and summarize the rest of it. But history.com writes that, in fact, as any fan of Lin-Manuel Miranda's blockbuster hip-hop musical Hamilton knows, Hamilton torpedoed his own presidential ambitions for good in 1797 when he published a tell-all pamphlet about the sordid details with a married woman, Maria Reynolds, and the blackmail payments he made to her husband to cover up the affair. Complete with illicit meetings, payments of hush money, and allegations of corruption, the Reynolds affair had all the trappings of a modern-day political sex scandal and was all the more shocking for being the first such drama in U.S. history. So what happens is, reportedly, Maria Reynolds approaches him and says that her husband is abusive and she needs to get away to her sister's, I think, up in New York City. But she doesn't have the money to do it. And she's like, I hear you're a great person. Can you give me money? And he's just like, yeah, I can maybe help you out with that. So later on, he brings her like a $30 note, but he brings it to her. And then he writes in his letter that it was clear that payment was going to, or repayment was going to be something different than money. So their affair begins there. But it gets weirder because her husband, her husband finds out about it. And so he blackmails, He goes and blackmails Alexander Hamilton for some pretty hefty money, actually. So I'll skip ahead to that part. Her husband, James Reynolds, confronts Hamilton via a letter and demanded $1,000, equivalent to $25,000 today, to keep quiet about the affair. Hamilton paid the full amount in two installments by January 1792. Dude's got some money. Not many people I know would just have $25,000 to just...
Yeah, and that probably was a lot more than it is now.
Well, so it was $1,000 then. The equivalent is $25,000 today.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. So he probably put it out in two $500 payments, but that was a ton of money back then. So I guess Reynolds was supposed to leave, but she stayed in Philadelphia. Or no, sorry. The husband stayed despite his promise to leave, like after the blackmail. He even encouraged Hamilton to resume the affair with his wife, who claimed to be devoted to her powerful lover. So that's a little bit of an odd twist, but it gets worse. Reynolds repeatedly asked Hamilton for smaller amounts in loans until finally Hamilton stops seeing Maria for good in the summer of 1792. But in November, and this is where it gets odd, in November, James Reynolds and an associate, Jacob Klingman, remember that name, were arrested and imprisoned for their involvement in a scheme to defraud the government by posing as the executors of deceased Revolutionary War veterans to get their back pay. While out on bail, Klingman approached his former employer, Frederick Muhlenberg, a congressman from Pennsylvania, and claimed that Reynolds had been involved in illegal speculations with none other than Alexander Hamilton. So now they're making up false claims about Hamilton. With two colleagues from Virginia, James Monroe and Abraham Venable, Muhlenberg visited James Reynolds in jail and Maria Reynolds at her home, then went to Hamilton's to confront him in person about these suspected illegal dealings. To their surprise and embarrassment, Hamilton came clean about his extramarital affair, even sharing the letters he received from both Mr. and Mrs. Reynolds. Monroe, Muhlenberg, and Venable left convinced that Hamilton was innocent of all except adultery and supposedly promised not to say anything more to anyone. But unbeknownst to Hamilton, Monroe sent copies of the documents. Hamilton had shown them to Jefferson, while John Beckley, then the clerk for the House of Representatives, also kept a copy. So basically, he ends up publishing this stuff saying, yeah, this happened. I was blackmailed, but I didn't have anything to do with what her husband was doing by trying to pose as veterans and get this back pay.
Right.
There ended up being a court case. And this is where Aaron Burr comes in. Aaron Burr was the legal representative for Miss Reynolds in the court case. And after I can't remember if she won or lost that one. I think she lost. But afterwards, she went and married Klingman, her husband's business partner in crime.
Well, she seems like a stand-up woman.
So this is what torpedoed it, was because the lawsuit largely came about because her husband was the one that was trying to basically grab money from veterans under false pretenses, which led to his sex scandal being disclosed. Surprisingly, he just came clean of it. But, you know, he did it.
Because the allegations that were coming before him were far worse than that.
He did
it
long before Bill Clinton.
Yes. It just goes to show human nature has not changed a ton.
No, and it looks like it was here at the very beginning.
Yeah, it doesn't look like... And I know everyone... It's we live in a weird culture where if someone does one thing wrong, that means it invalidates anything else that they've ever done. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the case. Like, I read this and I agreed with most of it, if not all of it, mm-hmm. and I didn't need to know all those things to believe what this is, what he's saying here is true. Now, you know, he's not writing a book on marriage, which is probably good.
Yep.
He's writing about government and how he wants to set it up so that there isn't too much power going on. So that's an interesting backstory to these people, that they were human beings. They were people too.
They're not perfect. They
definitely not.
They had their strengths and their flaws. And I think I'd like to give a little bit of a timeline, take like 15 seconds, and then I'll let you jump into it. I see you've got your bookmarks up and ready to go.
Yep. Again, I think this is going to be a quick intro today. Mm. So nothing insane.
All right. So just to give everybody a timeline. So we've already mentioned that the Federalist Papers were replacing the Confederate articles. I say that right?
I think it's both Confederate articles. Articles of the Confederacy. Either way, there's a possessive.
I think Confederate articles is the one used most.
Okay.
But this is kind of, well, the Federalist Papers are not replacing those. The Constitution is, but the Federalist Papers kind of go hand in hand with why we would need the Constitution and how to use it. But to give a little bit of a timeline here to place everybody. So 1763 to 1774 was a host of series of actions by Britain that led up to the War for Independence. That war continued from 1775 to 1782. After that, the Articles of Confederation were ratified in 1781 and was the precursor to the Constitution. Now, we've already seen, according to Hamilton, that they weren't good. And they needed something else, something to be redone. So the Constitution was drafted and then signed on September 17th. I think, when was that date? That 1781? I don't think I had that date on here. Do you have that when they, the year that they drafted the Constitution? Because it wasn't signed until 1788. Okay, my bad. No, I know that was it took them about a year to do it. So it was 1787 when the Constitution was signed. But it wasn't until the next year because they had 9 more states that they needed to get ratified. And that's kind of where the Federalist Papers came in. So the Federalist Papers were published on October 1787. So a month later from the signing of the Constitution. And that's about where we start off, where Hamilton and then John Jay at least start off kind of pleading with people that some sort of centralized government or a union, as they referred to it, is needed for the sake of the country.
Right. Yep. Nope. That's right. And I think so the first 10, which is the ones that we've kind of gone through, and we're going to go through these a little bit more next week. But if I'm like a normal citizen, I'd be like, why do we need a union? Why can't we just all be our own separate things? Right. Because we all have the different states. Like, we've grown up that way. It's like, oh yeah, we have the states, there's a government in the states. We have, we're here in North Carolina, so we have the North Carolina Senate. We have representatives in Congress and all that stuff. We're used to that, but they're like, why can't we just be our own separate things?
And this is especially interesting today, while the talk of a peaceful divorce is extremely prevalent amongst both conservatives and liberals, who are just getting fed up with dealing with the other one's ideologies and policies.
Right, because there's been a lot of talk about conservatives about separating, which even the founding fathers were like, listen, if we separate and we're going to go, we'll go against each other, and then we'll go against our enemies, and also by having dispute that's domestic, that's also going to weaken, weakening the country. It says here in the, I believe this is the second one. Nope, this is the fourth one. I was wrong. So in the fourth one, we have Jay. He says, apply these facts to our own case. Leave America divided into 13, or if you would please, into 3 or 4 independent governments. What armies could they raise and pay? What fleets could they ever hope to have? If one was attacked, would the others fly to a succor? Ooh, what's that word? Don't know that one. I can't read and go into the mic at the same time. This is an awkward situation for me. And spend their blood and money in its defense. Would there be no danger of being flattered into neutrality by its specious promises, or seduced by too great fondness for peace to decline, hazarding their tranquility and present safety for the sake of the neighbors? And he continues on and on and on. But this idea that if at this point there are 13 colonies, and they're like, what could we possibly hope to accomplish if we have 13 separate armies? But what if we did have a more united force on the front end, which would come from the federal government, from what I'm understanding. So there is that aspect to it. And so he kind of first talks about...
Well, remember, they just came out of a war against Britain.
Right. And so
which
that's...
Which was a centralized force of government that had bared down on them with, oh my gosh, all the different taxes. Actually, I'll pull up a list of it just so everybody can kind of get an idea. It was just one thing after another. They had the tea tax, and that's what resulted in the Boston Harbor, and then you ended up with the Boston Massacre, and the sugar tax, and all the other things, and all of that comes up to why coffee is so popular in America today.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, because that's what they switched to, from my understanding, when tea was just taxed out the wazoo, and they didn't want to pay for it anymore.
Right, so they understand that having one force is like, when I read these letters, like, they do feel kind of complicated, but when you leave them, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I can boil it down to this one idea of, we ought to stay together because we are stronger that way. And they kind of go into the different reasons why. So the first ones are about, okay, here are the dangers of foreign force and influence on us. And they talk about that for a few papers. And then they talk about the war between the states. That also continues for a little bit. Then they talk about the effects of internal war. So they're talking a lot about having conflict between the states and how that will also affect our relationship with other countries. And what was also very interesting about these letters is that they referenced history quite a bit. They said, we shouldn't do X because we saw what happened over here. And let's not forget about this country. And then they go into these different details. And so they look back to history and they say, yeah, this is not a great idea. We saw what happened here. It seems that America now is almost incapable of doing that, being like, okay, like with socialism, it's like, okay, we've seen X, Y, and Z country, you know, Cuba going, trying socialism. And of course, like, we just haven't done it right. I'm like, how do you do it right? I don't understand. But we see these different countries doing different things and this is not working. Why would we try to do this? Mm-hmm. So it seems like they have these are obviously, whether you agree with them or not, they're incredibly intelligent men. And they seem like they have an incredibly good grasp of history to say, let's not forget these other countries that have done these things and have failed. We've seen examples of that. Therefore, we should try something different.
And they did not have Google.
They did not have Google. This is true. So that's basically what the first 10 letters is about, is the idea of safeguarding the Union from outside influence and domestic influence and the effects that war between the states would have on the strength of the Union as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what we're going to be getting into next week, is talking a little bit about that, but also talking a little bit about how we should be taking that into today, and what kind of what we should be looking out for and kind of the aha moments. Cause I feel like as I was reading these, I had a lot of aha, like, oh, I didn't, it looks like they actually knew what they were talking about. Yeah. Like they really did. So that's kind of, again, short summary, kind of fun. I didn't know that much about Hamilton. I guess that's why he has a whole musical for himself.
Have an affair, get a musical.
Yep. But we are excited to continue the series. I'm kind of excited to learn more, cause we're all learning together, and it should be fun. And yeah,
and you guys have a chance to follow along with us. Like I said, you can grab a copy off Amazon, or even you have a library, you can go to your library and probably find it there as well. But just to be able to follow along with us in this podcast, that would probably be a pretty neat experience for our listeners.
For sure. And if you're like Jordan, the Federalist Papers are too complicated, the language is a lot, hear you there. Glenn Beck has a great version of the Federalist Papers that's put into more modern language for you to understand. You can pick that up and you might find that to be more enjoyable. Mm-hmm. For the sake of this podcast, I will be reading the originals because I feel like that's probably the right thing for me to do, but please read whatever is easiest for you.
Yeah, I'm probably going to end up going back and forth because get a hard copy and then I have to sit next to a computer anyways to look up definitions for words that I've never heard of and don't understand. That is something nice about reading it online, is you can quickly double click and search that word to grab a definition. So if you guys are going to be on the move, probably recommend the Modern English book to get through it, because there are a lot of very,
very complicated,
very, very complicated, interesting words in here that will expand your dictionary.
It will. But I think that's it for today. And we'll be back next week with the first 10 papers. And we'll kind of go over those again in a general manner, but still get into some specifics as well.
Definitely. Definitely interested to see how it's going to relate to our country as it is today.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm excited. It's going to be good. All right, guys. Have fun. Have a good week. Stay safe. Don't read and drive. Be responsible with your Federalist Papers.